Folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. It is just a third of our podcast goodness that you could be listening to right now. That's right. On the free version, we give you 1 hour's worth, radio's hour's worth of content. But if you want the full radio program in all its glory, without commercials, sign up to become a member at ROFpodcast.com. It is the only way that we create revenue for this program, folks. So if you want this show to continue and you're enjoying the free show, support it by becoming a member. We've got a good deal if you want to buy a yearly subscription. And as a bonus, you also get to look up any of our archives. We've got thousands, literally thousands of interviews that may interest you. ROFpodcast.com. Thanks very much. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Robert Borisaj, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, will tell us why the Republican tax plan is really just a plan to rob America. Investigative journalist David Dayen will join us to discuss his special investigation into how J.P. Morgan Chase actually used other people's money to pay off a fine for their misdeeds during the 2008 financial meltdown. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to run down the most important news stories from the past week. And law professor Scott Lemieux will be here to break down the important cases on the docket of the Supreme Court this session. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me make sense of another whirlwind week news, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, a lot of stuff to talk about this week, as is the norm in this era of Trumpism. But there are, I mean, let's start with the most harrowing, and I guess we'll work our way down to the more banal and ridiculous. We know at the beginning of the week, we saw Bob Corker, soon to be retired senator from Tennessee, and that's when all these Republicans get their courage, of course, come out and say that he was very concerned that the president didn't have the right temperament and could be driving us to World War III. And then it seemed like Corker shook loose not any elected Republican because they can't open their mouths because of who elects them, but it sort of shook loose sort of off the record quotes and stories that filled out things with the Tillerson situation and what's going on with the generals, all of which, you know, centered around nukes and perhaps North Korea.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that this is what Tillerson is talking about. Now, there's a lot on the table, of course, in terms of national security, including the Iran deal, which, by the way, you know, Trump blamed, you know, Corker for, but that's ridiculous. He was actually against the Iran deal, but he does sort of believe that a country should back, you know, its treaties and, you know, that your word is should be worth something. But having said all that, I really think this nuclear thing, is what prompted Corker to speak out. And he started speaking out last summer, after it was, speaking with people like Tillerson, who called Trump an effing moron, after a meeting, evidently, in which he asked for, according to NBC News, in which he asked for a gigantic increase in the nuclear arsenal.
And which Donald Trump did.
Right, Donald Trump did. Sorry, yeah, sorry. Donald Trump had asked for an in front of the asked the military brass about how he could increase the nuclear arsenal, and the day before, and this should be noted, this was when they were talking about the Afghanistan plan, and Trump was saying that we really should be taking all the minerals, and he'd been talking to some vets somewhere who told him that NATO wasn't carrying its weight, and he told this story about how you should listen to the grunts instead of the generals. Because he related this story about the 21 Club in New York and how they had called in experts that didn't know what they were doing. Of course, that story was untrue. In any case, this series of events that happened last summer showed, I think, made pretty clear to Tillerson and a variety of other people, including Bob Corker, I imagine, that Trump is unfit to be the commander-in-chief, and that this nuclear issue was rising to the top of the pile of the most important things that we're dealing with. So I think this is coming to a head. We can hear Trump last week had a meeting with all of his military brass in the cabinet room, including H.R. McMaster, who was in uniform for this thing. Very unusual. He's usually considered in a civilian position, even though he is an active duty general. In which Trump told these people that he ordered his generals to deliver to him battle plans and military options in a quick and efficient manner, that they were taking too long to tell him what his military options were. Now, in my view, that probably means the generals are hoping he forgets about it and moves on to the NFL or something. But he said, no, he wanted that. It was after that meeting that he came out, called the press in, surrounded by military, and said, this is the calm before the storm, and nobody knew what he was talking about. We still don't really, but all of this adds up to this ominous sort of atmosphere that I think is in the White House and among the national security people that propelled Corker to come out and actually start talking about this, which, it's always so interesting to me. He said to the New York Times, everybody on Capitol Hill knows about this. We're all talking about it. It's just, it's the talk of the town. Reporters say this too. Reporters say that they know, they hear this all the time from the people on Capitol Hill. Some Democrats do speak up, guys like Brian Schatz and Chris Murphy, and of course people in the House like Ted Lieu. I mean, they've been sounding the alarm from the beginning. But for the most part, you don't even hear Democrats saying this stuff out loud. That we have a dangerous lunatic in the White House who's about to launch nuclear war, or World War III is on the table here, everybody wake up. So it's like we're all watching this thing, and Corker comes out and says this, and that was supposed to be what, that would burst the dam, and that everybody would, suddenly say, well, look, this guy's got credibility, we should stand up behind him, blah, blah, blah. Nothing. Crickets. All these people, all I heard yesterday was, or actually it was last week earlier, was when Joni Ernst came out and said, I just wish they'd both shut up. We have more important things to do. I mean, they need to stop talking about nuclear war because she's got tax cuts on the brain. And that's where we are. And it's like, it's terrifying to me. Absolutely terrifying.
Well, I mean, what is clear here is that there's, and I don't know what Corker thinks is supposed to happen at this point. I mean, it is, clearly, and then we see, stories of, it was reported this week by Gabe Sherman at Vanity Fair that he has talked to high-level Republicans in the government who say, who joke about the idea that Mattis and Kelly, would tackle him if he goes for the nuclear football. The idea being that there is genuine concern in the highest levels of our government that Donald Trump is about or could do something that may create a nuclear conflict. And, I have to say that there's a couple of things that are very worrying in that respect. I think his trip to Puerto Rico, we talked about this last week, but his trip to Puerto Rico was so disturbing to watch how little empathy he had, even though he was in such close proximity to the suffering of hundreds of thousands of people, a million and a half Americans, and seem to completely lack even enough empathy to realize that he should at least project that he cares, right? Instead of coming out of that trip going like, nobody appreciated the beautiful towels, the paper towels I sent to people. I mean, this is lunacy. And I think that, you know, when you start to contemplate the idea that he is, you know, mulling over the idea that he could press a button and kill people who he has no relationship with, it's very terrifying. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, let's talk about this dynamic where Bob Corker can come out and say something and then just crickets. We'll be right back after this. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, we were talking about the stories this week that were reported out that range from Bob Corker really making a very, very strong, and don't get me wrong here, and I know you don't. Bob Corker, I find to be an odious character who completely enabled Donald Trump to become president. Right. And it was, he was definitely excited about it when he thought that it could mean some more neoconservative agenda and that maybe he'd be Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. Of course, he was bumped out of the running by Donald Trump when Donald Trump found out how short he was and he wanted a tall Secretary of State. I'm not joking, folks. This is what's being reported. Mm-hmm. And this week, we hear these stories of why Tillerson called his boss an effing moron. We hear stories of the generals being concerned about nukes. We hear stories about Donald Trump getting upset that his presidency was during the low ebb of the size of our nuclear arsenal relative to the 60s, and so wanting to increase it by times 10. And then just midweek, we were sending two bombers over South Korea as a way of, like, you know, I guess intimidating North Korea. And it seems to me the problem is this, is that Donald Trump thinks he's playing a game where he's intimidating the North Koreans. And it seems that other people who are smarter about this stuff realize, like, North Korea has very few options. And one of them is not to give up their nukes and to, you know, capitulate. I mean, it's an autocratic society. They can't show weakness. And Donald Trump doesn't seem to understand this. And people are afraid that we're getting into a brinksmanship that could be disastrous.
Well, yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, think about, I heard some statistics, and I can't vouch for them, but I heard it, that they figure that in the first day of any kind of, and this isn't necessarily even a nuclear confrontation, if war breaks out or that some kind of military confrontation leads to war breaking out, they figure that 1 million people will die the first day in South Korea. There will be 2 million dead between Seoul and Tokyo if if that happens. I mean, these you know, people are all in very close proximity. You know, we're not talking about San Francisco, at least not yet, or even Honolulu or Guam. We're talking about two countries that are right there. He doesn't need to have ICBMs and nuclear weapons,
right?
To absolutely create, you know, one of the worst Holocaust that we have seen since World War II. This could absolutely happen. And Trump doesn't seem to understand this. He said last week he was in a meeting with Justin Trudeau from Canada, and they were talking about, you know, whatever, NAFTA and what have you. And he was asked about this, and he said, when it comes to North Korea, I listen to everyone's advice, but I have a different attitude than most people, and my attitude is the one that matters. I'm stronger and tougher. And, you know, his attitude is the one that matters. He said that outright. I do not trust the idea that this guy is playing a game. I'm not sure that he is. I think he thinks that he's intimidating, exactly as you say, and has zero understanding of the game, you know, the negotiation or the intimidation dominance game that he's playing. He does not understand the stakes. The empathy observation that you made is absolutely correct. He doesn't see that. I mean, a million people in Seoul, South Korea could die on the first day if he makes a miscalculation here. And he's just popping off on Twitter saying, you know, and you know, he changed the stakes in all this. He told the foreign minister of Korea via Twitter that if he said anything he didn't like, that he would destroy the country. He didn't say if you do something we don't like. He said, if you say something we don't like. So he's talking about preemption here. And that is a whole new level when you're talking about a nuclear armed state. It's very, very scary. Very.
It's terrifying. And I think there does seem to be, and in the next hour, I want to talk a little bit more about maybe the media, but the thing that's becoming clearer to me is, you know, as we start to get a sense of where Donald Trump is and is not losing his popularity, the media on this, there's like a similar quality to almost to global warming. You know, it gets mentioned, but it's almost as if everyone is just like, we are at the mercy of maybe a couple of military generals in the White House stopping Donald Trump from, you know, launching an attack on North Korea. And that's the best case scenario. That's a horrible scenario. You don't want to have to be relying on the military.
His handpicked generals.
Of course. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to rely on my handpicked generals to be there. You don't want generals at all.
That's not how it works.
But
not how this works.
But we're all just sort of, it's as if Donald Trump has rounded us all up and forced us to sit here and watch some horrible, horrible movie. And we have there's no escaping it. It really is bad. And, and the bottom line is, I guess we can give Bob Corker some measure of credit that I guess... Or maybe he's just made calculations that as he retires, he's not going to get his money from people who support Trump. All well and good. But the silence from the Republican Party, which who enables this president, is shocking and deafening.
Shocking.
Listen, Heather, if you'll join me in the next hour, I want to talk about the sort of the media bubble that is being constructed around the voters of those Republican leaders, and they may provide an explanation of why they are so cowardly about challenging Donald Trump. We'll be right back after this. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, David Dayen will talk about his special investigation into J.P. Morgan Chase's scheme to pay off their legal fines. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
It's in my blood. It's in my water. You tried to tame me from the start. When that deadness in your eye, flash your flesh.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. In the wake of the 2008 financial crash, our next guest uncovered that J.P. Morgan met part of its $8.2 billion settlement burden by forgiving mortgages on houses it no longer owned, an evidence that CEO Jamie Dimon knew about this misbehavior. Add to that, government regulators may have been enabling the whole thing. Here to discuss his special investigation in The Nation magazine entitled Behind the J.P. Morgan Chase's Bait and Switch, my good friend David Dayan. So, David, this piece in The Nation magazine is the culmination of several months of investigative work and also came from a man who dealt with J.P. Morgan Chase and uncovered basically through his own great misfortune in dealing with J.P. Morgan Chase a rather important story about Chase's, essentially paying of a fine. So let's start it at the beginning. Why don't you tell us what that fine, I think people remember, but what that fine was about?
Right. So J.P. Morgan Chase, like all banks, committed some illicit, some would say, fraudulent practices during the rise of the housing bubble and its aftermath. It's the financial collapse. And there was there were a number of settlements, civil settlements, that the government entered into for this misconduct. And it's a variety of misconduct: lying to investors, ripping off homeowners, using false evidence in court. And most of this misconduct was wrapped up in these settlements. And the unifying feature of all of these settlements was that most of the penalty, the cash penalty that was announced, wasn't in hard dollars. It went, it was this thing called consumer relief. And consumer relief meant that J.P. Morgan Chase would cut the balances of mortgage loans that troubled homeowners who were struggling to keep up with their payments had, and they would use that relief to satisfy their obligation under the settlement. So the idea was supposed to be, yes, J.P. Morgan pays this price, and some people get to stay in their homes.
And this is like the equivalent of some form of plea deal, I guess, but in civil terms, and some notion of like, okay, here's the plea deal. And maybe you're going to get community service so that it benefits the community, or maybe you have to pay back. Maybe you have to work a certain number of hours as restitution.
Right.
That's the dynamic here, right? Prosecutors.
Yeah, the idea is that in addition to paying a punishment, we're going to try to get something done that works in the public interest. People were losing homes at record numbers. And if we can get some money toward them to relieve their burden, then maybe they can stay in their homes. So the idea was kind of a two birds with one stone thing.
All right. Well, that sounds good. And maybe we can talk a little bit later in this this talk about how actually that would have been a great model for the U.S. government to have engaged in, frankly, around that time. OK, so that sounds all well and good. You're going to give homeowner relief to what is it, like tens of thousands of people? And
It was a million that was the promise at the beginning of the biggest of these settlements, the national mortgage settlement of 2012, with five banks, including J.P. Morgan Chase. However, when this this whole settlement was written, it was written with the input of mortgage bankers that knew ways that they could game this settlement so that they would, quote unquote, pay a price, but it wouldn't affect them really directly. They could pay with other people's money. And this story that we found is the most extreme example of that.
All right. So how is it that the J.P. Morgan Chase managed to pay off this fine, essentially get credit for giving breaks to homeowners to basically pay down this fine? How did they go about doing it?
Right. So here's what they did. They had this storehouse of loans that were really, you know, over 180 days overdue. They had these terrible toxic qualities. These were loans they wanted off their books anyway. And in 2009 or thereabouts, they sold a big package of these loans to this guy, Larry Schneider. And they sold them with the idea that they have no more interest in these loans whatsoever. They sold them off. 3 years later, many of Larry Schneider's borrowers start getting letters in the mail from J.P. Morgan Chase saying, because of a settlement with the federal government, we are canceling your loan. You don't have to pay anymore on this loan. They didn't own these properties anymore. They had no interest in these properties anymore. Yet they decided to go ahead and cancel the mortgages on them, or at least appear to. And this had, you know, multiple different benefits for J.P. Morgan Chase. Number one,
let's stop here for a moment, and let's just go backward here. So I want people to really understand. In 2009, J.P. Morgan Chase has this group of loans, this tranche of loans,
yes,
worth how many millions of dollars?
It was about $156 million all told in raw value. Like if every dime was paid on these loans, that's
okay.
How much it would be.
So they have these loans. They know these are very bad loans. It could range from they're delinquent, but also the origination of these loans was probably also problematic. Maybe they don't have
that's
documentation
correct.
To support it. Maybe it was like the ninja loans or the liar loans or whatever it was.
Right.
And they don't want it on their books. Why? Why do they want to sell it so desperately?
For several reasons. For several reasons. Number one, they don't think that these are going to be collectible loans at all. So they're going to be liabilities, right? So any money they can get for them in the public market is a plus. Number two, because they had these defects in them that you just referred to, they didn't want federal regulators to see them because they know that they were fraudulent in some way or another. And if regulators got a hold of them, they would know that there was legal exposure on the part of J.P. Morgan Chase for originating or perpetuating these loans. So they just wanted them out. They wanted to walk away from these loans. Now, when the settlement comes up, they realize that they have to take credit for releasing a bunch of loans. They have to, you know, be able to find loans that they're able to cut the balance on. So what better way to do that than to find loans that they don't own anymore, cut the balance, which costs them nothing, and take credit under the settlement for those properties.
So in their thinking, too, they sell off. Now, if it's $156 million worth of loans, if they had been paid off, I don't know. It's sort of hard to sort of figure out exactly how much money that involved, actual money that they paid out in those loans to people, because that $156 million reflects probably in many instances either a 10-year or 15-year or 30-year interest payments or something.
Yeah, it's a best-case scenario number. In certain case of these loans, it's nothing close to what they would actually reap from them. However, if they cancel the balances, they get to take a substantial portion of that balance as settlement credit. So these are really good loans for them because it costs them nothing to release them. And they get to take a large amount of credit under the National Mortgage Settlement, another settlement that they did, to get rid of the loan.
And effectively speaking, They could have found, I mean, this is be like the equivalent of them finding a list of people who had loans with other banks and just writing them and saying, guess what? We have now said you are released from your obligations with your loan, and we're going to take full credit for releasing your obligation and pay off our fine with that. God, you know, peace be with you. And
the reason they thought they could get away with that is because they never transferred the actual ownership documents to Larry Schneider. He had been trying for 3 years to get the promissory note and the mortgage and all of this information. They never delivered it to them. So Chase was able to sort of jump in and out of ownership whenever it suited them. If they wanted to, you know, take credit, they could say, oh, we own the loans. If they were getting heat from law enforcement, they could say, oh, we sold those loans to Larry Schneider. Don't worry about them. So this was the shell game that they were playing.
All right. I want to take a quick break. And when we come back, David, I want to start with, how do we know they were actually playing the shell game and it wasn't just incompetence? And what is the biggest piece of evidence that you found that implicates Jamie Dimon in terms of his knowledge that this was going on? Because we're going to hear if they have to account to this, and maybe they won't. Oh, I had no idea this was going on. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with David Dayan on this blockbuster story, how America's biggest bank paid its fine for the 2008 mortgage crisis with phony mortgages. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with David Dayan about his piece in The Nation magazine behind J.P. Morgan Chase's bait and switch. So, David, when we broke, you had told us the story of how J.P. Morgan Chase, following the 2008 financial crisis, offloaded potentially $156 million worth of loans to a guy, Larry Schneider, who bought them at really almost an impossible fraction of the price for $200,000. He bought these loans because, as far as J.P. Morgan Chase was concerned, he wasn't going to be able to collect on virtually any of these. And they were so toxic, they didn't want regulators to know that they had made them, because it would have raised some serious questions about the practices that J.P. Morgan had been engaging in the run-up to the 2008 crisis. And so they dumped these off on Larry Schneider, but 3 or 4 years later, 10 years later, 6 years later, rather, I should say, in paying off their fines for the mortgage crisis settlement, they pretended that they owned these loans and they could forgive them. So what happened at that point? Like, it's a shell game. You said at the end that sometimes they pretended like they owned them, sometimes they didn't, by not giving Larry Schneider the paperwork. How do we know that they were actually conscious of that and it wasn't just like some mess up?
Well, I mean, that's the classic argument, right? Or were these people incompetent or were they evil? It's hard to say. We know that they created this secret database of these toxic loans. And when they put loans in there, they essentially converted them to bad debt. They were no longer doing anything in terms of the handling of these loans that would be in any way legal. And because there was no real information tied to the loans in this secret database, these kinds of problems were inevitable to pop up. There was no tracking going on of anything going on with these loans. So maybe that gives them a plausible deniability to say, oh, well, we didn't know because we weren't tracking it, that we ended up selling loans that we didn't own anymore. And it wasn't just Schneider, by the way. It was 21 different investors. And in a sample of 500 loans of the many that they sent out these forgiveness letters to, 108 were found to have been sold to other third parties. That's 20%. So, you know, you can say that it was incompetence, but it seems like the design of this whole system and this whole project was designed to make that incompetence turn into a real benefit for J.P. Morgan Chase.
So it's quite possible that they got to the amount of loans that they wanted to forgive. I mean, let's put it this way. Could they have found, let's say, as part of their settlement, right, did they have to forgive every single loan written before a certain date? Or did they have to forgive or discount loans up to a certain price?
They got extra credit if they were forgiven by a certain date. There was a price. It was a very complicated formula on which, you know, you would get X percent of credit if you released this type of loan. You would get X percent of credit if you modified this type of loan. It's very complicated to explain. But what they did in their sort of rundown, and we have internal documents on this, is they said, we want to get this much money from the release of these kind of loans. The kind of loans they sold off to Larry Schneider. And in the first round of these releases, they said, we want to get $367 million of our settlement paid off from this tranche of loans, essentially, these kinds of worthless loans. So we have a sense that this was hundreds of millions of dollars of benefit to J.P. Morgan Chase.
And because, of course, they want to get as much credit as they can for loans that they expect to get nothing in return anyway. So it's no skin off their back whatsoever. It's just a matter of like
exactly.
the cost of the ink that we write on the letter, essentially. Is
that's
what
correct.
It is.
And the point of the settlement was this two birds with one stone idea, right? That we were going to punish a bank for misconduct and we were going to help homeowners. The way in which J.P. Morgan Chase went about this, not only were they not punished because they were passing off loans that were worthless to them, but no homeowners were helped. Like, you know, when you release a loan that's worthless, where the homeowner vacated the property and abandoned it and is gone, this does nothing for the homeowner. In fact, it hurts them because now they get a letter from the city where that property was saying you now owe property taxes because J.P. Morgan Chase relinquished all interest in the property and now it revokes, you know, reverts back to you. And this is an abandoned property. It has mold on it and overgrown weeds or whatever. So this was a terrible situation for homeowners. It actually hurt them rather than helped them. And this was supposed to be a settlement that was helping homeowners.
All right. We have just about a minute and a half or so left. That part about the what it does to the city when the bank says, okay, we no longer own these foreclosed properties, and the original owners are like, hey, wait a second, we left those a long time ago. Now you're sticking me with all responsibility for something I had already eaten. What does that have to do with Jamie Dimon in Detroit and why we know that Jamie Dimon had some inkling of this?
Yes. So these cities end up eating that cost, and it becomes a really bad reputational problem for the bank that they're ruining these cities with urban blight. We have documents that show in minutes of meetings in late 2013 and 2014 that the instruction came down from Jamie Dimon, it's directly from Jamie Dimon, to not release loans in the city of Detroit. Now, in May of 2014, Jamie Dimon, with much fanfare, bestows this $100 million gift to the city of Detroit for their ongoing recovery. And clearly, there would be a problem if he was doing that, and at the same time, J.P. Morgan was responsible for all this blight in the city of Detroit. And so there was some reason that J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon wanted Detroit held, you know, shielded from this project. And we have direct evidence of his involvement to do that shielding. And that is different than a lot of these other bank machinations. It's usually not at that level.
David Day, and people should go check out the piece in The Nation, this current issue of The Nation magazine. It's really devastating, and I hope we do a follow-up. I hope somebody does. I hope there's some activity that we can report on in the future, because this is crazy. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. It's a crazy story, and I expect more to come.
David Day is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Winner of the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. He contributes to The Nation, The Intercept, The American Prospect, Vice, and more. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from this past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, check out ROFpodcast.com to catch up on what you missed this show.